back into the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Well, I stop and I dance and I go for a ride till I get to the bottom. I see you again.
Hello again and welcome to I've Got a Beatles Podcast with Dave and Chris. And we were just listening to a song that's going to be the subject. We're going to go into the lab today here and put this one under the microscope. And
that's right.
Of course,
I've got my jacket on.
You got your lab coat, you got your glasses, you got everything ready to go here, because it's time for Songs Under the Microscope Volume 3, Helter Skelter.
Yeah. I guess we'll put the slide in. And take a look. When we get to the bottom of the slide, we'll know what this song's all about. Of course, that was Helter Skelter that we're going to talk about.
That's right. Helter Skelter, which is, I don't know, I'd probably say it's a kind of a controversial track in Beatles history. It's one of those black and white kind of songs. You either love it or you hate it, it seems, that most people seem to think. And I have to admit, I'm in one of those categories, but I've kind of come around a little bit this week, doing the preparation. I'm, you know, excited to talk about it now.
I take it you're in the don't love it category. I got to be honest, I've always kind of been in that category as well.
Hmm.
But I've been majorly turned around by something recently on it as well. So I'm very interested to talk about this. And of course, there's another element of it that we'll talk about, a little bit of history that has attached itself to this.
One of the reasons we chose to do Helter Skelter is because recently the prosecutor for the Charles Manson trials, Vincent Bugliosi, passed away. And I don't know if some of you, our listeners have read the book Helter Skelter. It's one of the greatest true crime books I think ever written. And the preface of the book says, this book it will scare the hell out of you, or something like that. And that's how I've always felt about, which it's a great book, but I've always felt about Helter Skelter. The song is pretty scary, and the White Album has kind of an ominous tone about it, and definitely the Charles Manson stuff that we'll talk about later has an ominous tone. So maybe as we put the song under the microscope, it's kind of figuring out why the song has those kinds of connotations to it, and kind of how it's been received in Beatle history. Now, we played to open the show a recent recording of Paul doing the song, because he's still playing it in concert. So, you know, obviously he still thinks it's worth playing.
I got to say, too, when I went to see Paul in Milwaukee, and I took my girlfriend Hillary and her mother, and my girlfriend Hillary, unbeknownst to me, just loves this song.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And when this played, went absolutely wild.
Hmm.
It was like dancing like crazy to it, and just like with reckless abandon. So it was very much like, oh wow, I don't really have that deep of a connection to this song personally, but many people very much do.
Yeah. There was a guy I went to high school with named Nelson, and we would go to now it's called the Fest for Beatle Fans, but we used to go to Beatle Fest in Chicago. And the cover band there, Liverpool, he would always yell out "Helter Skelter, da na 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 na," in hopes that they would play it, but they never did, and it was just kind of embarrassing. And he would do air guitar and everything as well, so it was pretty great. But so, like you say, you know, some people just have a real affinity for this song, and well, it could be a lot of things. Well, I don't know. What are some of the reasons you think that it's really stuck as we kind of get into it here?
Well, one thing I hadn't really thought about came up when I was researching this, and what I did is I came across an interview that Paul McCartney did on the Howard Stern show, and Howard actually kind of brought something up about this song that I never really thought about. So let's hear a little bit of that, this interview. They'll talk about that thing, and then they'll also talk about sort of the origins of what gave Paul the idea for this song. So let's hear a little bit of this interview with Howard Stern.
When I get a half hour, I feel like, oh, I'm not going to be able to handle it. But I was just playing Metallica's music, and it got me thinking. The song Helter Skelter, okay? People have said, and I wonder if you agree with this, that this was really the beginning of heavy metal music. Do you buy
into
that?
Have you thought about
that? Have you ever thought of that?
I will buy that theory. I don't think of it like that, but when you look back at that period, I can't remember anything else that was doing this.
Right.
Because it was before Led Zeppelin or anything like that.
Before Zeppelin, yeah.
And I guess I get hung up on that kind of thing. Like, do you get hung up on that? Like, do you want the full credit for maybe inventing heavy metal music?
You know, Howard, I got so much credit for this and that. I don't need a bit more.
But for some reason, that matters to me. That you get...
You know, I would go for that.
You would go for that.
I would accept that credit, yeah. You know what happened?
Yeah.
I read in a music paper that The Who were putting out a new record.
Right.
And Pete Townsend, I think, was quoted, and he said, "It's the dirtiest, grittiest, filthiest piece of music." I went, "Oh, we've got to get there before they do," or something, you know. So I went to the guys and said, "We've got to make the dirtiest, filthiest, grittiest." So, you know,
that's
what we made.
That's where this came from? Wow.
Very interesting. So the inspiration coming from The Who.
Yeah.
And what was that song that they actually came out with? That was the dirtiest, filthiest, nastiest song.
Well, the song was "I Can See for Miles." And when Paul actually heard the song, he was disappointed. But he was like, well, I still got the idea for that song, so let's do it. What I think's interesting is that it did turn into a pretty heavy, like, really the first song I can think of that sounds really kind of heavy metal.
Yeah.
So maybe it did lead into that. But mm-hmm. But when they started recording the song, they weren't really doing it the way we ended up hearing it.
Right, exactly. If you listen to the... Well, so they recorded this two times, in two different periods here. So they recorded it early in 1968, and that's the version that you can hear on Anthology 3, which we're going to play shortly. But the famous version, the one that actually made it onto the album, was recorded a bit later in 1968. And they have a completely different vibe, completely different feel to them. We'll talk about the different... Well, obviously you'll hear it, but the feel and the inspiration was very different. So do you want to... Maybe we should listen to the Anthology version, which, and kind of comment on that, which I'm sure a lot of you have probably heard, but if you haven't, I think you'll find it pretty interesting. So, obviously a lot slower and a lot bluesier than what later was released. So what we just heard was, according to the liner notes in Anthology 3, mercifully shortened to about 4.5 to 5 minutes because they actually recorded about 3 takes of this, and one was over 27 minutes long of freeform jam improvisational sound. And
that's turned into kind of one of the most, that and maybe Carnival of Light.
Yes.
Turned into one of the most, like, boy, we want a release of that kind of outtakes from the Beatles that we've never gotten an official release of.
Yep.
Wonder if we will.
I don't know. It would be interesting just to hear it maybe once is probably all I could take. But that's kind of the problem with the 24-minute jam by the Beatles. The Beatles aren't really a jam band, and so I don't know what happened. Like, how did they keep it going? But that would be, I don't know, pretty interesting to find out.
I know if I was playing drums for 24 minutes, yeah. I'd get blisters on my fingers.
Exactly. Absolutely. So we were talking during the, when we were listening to that Anthology version, you were saying if they had maybe polished that up a little bit, you would have liked that slower version, maybe a released version of that.
Yeah, I think maybe so. I would have been into that. But it is interesting what we got, because apparently it was like, what, 2 months, and then they're like, you know what, let's have another pass at that. I don't think it's dirty gritty enough.
Nastiest, raucous rock and roll. Yeah, so it completely changed its character by that point. You know, now might be a good time to talk about the music and the lyrics about the song. You know, first of all, Helter Skelter. What is Helter Skelter? What does that even mean? I mean, we use it one way, but people from the UK might have a different meaning.
Well, it is a slide that you slide down at an amusement park. So it's interesting that he was using that imagery that probably is pretty vivid in the minds of, say, British people, but maybe not necessarily so of, I don't know, back in 1968 America, if, you know, a lot of people knew what a Helter Skelter was. But right. But it also, the terminology for it from British people, even though it also just described a slide, was topsy-turvy, things all going crazy.
Yeah, like you say when you're at a, I don't know, some restaurant, and there's a kid screaming, and people are waiting in line, and someone drops a plate, and everything's just all chaos. You say, everything's all helter-skelter in here. I can't figure out what's going on. I can't make sense of anything. And I think the music really exhibits that kind of just all over the place feel. Some of the authors I was reading, and I would agree, say it's pretty out of tune and just raucous sounding, and that it's just all over the place, and it's heavy metal kind of sound, and very simple musical structure here. You've just got 3 chords, and it's sort of in the key of E. You've got a G and an A chord, and that's it. So no dominant or no B major chord, which you would expect, or anything kind of traditional. So very simple to play. But what makes it interesting is the riff, all the riffs that go through this. It's a really a riff-based song. And that's like we were talking about with the slide going down. One of my favorite things with the lyrics is when he sings the chorus of Helter Skelter, you have the da-da-da-da-da-da-da going down, like you're going down the slide. So it's a nice word painting or text painting there. So that's a cool thing. So I don't know, what else, what do you find in the lyrics or the connections?
Well, this...
what's it about anyway? What do you think? Anything?
Well, Paul had been quoted at some point saying, like, you know, well, it's not about too much, but a little bit about the fall of the Roman Empire. kind of like they wanted to symbolize the feeling of falling societally. And you know, this is the same album that has Revolution on
and
it,
Blackbird,
well.
Yeah,
and Blackbird. So, I do think there was a little bit behind that. That was probably overblown later, you know. The key thing is that Paul just wanted to make a hard sounding crazy song, right? You know,
and this
kind
gives
recently did that with Cut Me Some Slack.
Yeah, just exactly.
Just a loud song. I just want to make a loud song. It doesn't really matter what the lyrics are about, but you know, I think that's why I bristle a little bit in getting too deep into a lyrical analysis of something that the guy has said he just tried to write a song that, you know, sounded
exactly.
So
yeah, and the singing or the you know, screaming, if you will, is is very much a part of this, that whole noise kind of sound here. And it's interesting, you know, who's playing the riffs. It's not necessarily who you'd expect, although now it makes sense, but that's Paul. So Paul and George are playing guitar on this one. John's playing bass and some
saxophone
at the end. Yeah.
Bizarro saxophone. Yeah.
Sounds like he's kind of just chewing the reed or squeaking there. Mal Evans is playing a pretty raucous sounding trumpet at the end. And then Ringo, of course, is on drums. So,
well, Brian Gibson, the technical engineer, remembered the session being long, and I'll quote here from a book. This is the big red book I use all the time, all the songs, the story behind every Beatles release. And it says from Brian Gibson, they were completely out of their heads that night. And this is the 21st take.
Wow.
So they're playing for a long time. They're getting wilder, more out of tune, crazier.
Isn't there a story about George walking around with an ashtray, a flaming ashtray over his head, and kind of trying to get some sort of a weird bonfire thing going in there? All sorts of crazy stuff happening in that session. Kind of fits in with the mood.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what gives you this sort of screaming. I mean, if you've ever listened to Paul's isolated vocal track on this, it's pretty... you know, don't let me break you. You know, it's like doing extra stuff after every line, you know, just like really losing his voice.
Oh, yeah.
And somebody else was losing feeling in some of their hands and famously shouts at the end of the stereo version only of this song, "I got blisters on my fingers," and that was Ringo.
Yes, that's one of the greatest all-time lines in rock history, of course. And like you said, that only is heard on the stereo version. And if you buy the mono version, which I did recently, I bought the White Album on mono vinyl, or the mono vinyl White Album recently. And I highly recommend, if you've got a record player, buying at least one of those releases. It just has completely changed the way I hear it. But that song is one of the ones that has some noticeable changes, and one of them is that it's about a minute shorter, the mono version, and you don't get Ringo yelling, "I've got blisters on my fingers," at the end.
Yeah, the stereo version fades out and then fades back in sort of slowly. The mono version doesn't do that, and there is a spectacular difference in the mono version's mixing towards the end, where almost everything drops out, and then you hear Ringo coming in with a rat-tat-tat-tat.
Yep.
That just like made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It's just fantastic.
Yeah.
I gotta say, I've never really cared that much for this song until I've heard the White Album mono vinyl version,
mm-hmm.
which I think is so good, so spectacular, and you can hear. You can hear everything going on. You can hear that saxophone. You can hear the dissonant piano kind of being punked at. It's just really, really great. I would. It's sort of turned me around on the song because I've always just been kind of ho-hum about it. And very recently, it's not been a skipper at all.
I'm with you on that one, especially because of that. Yeah, that mono version has just changed the way I've heard it. And maybe that's because it's a minute shorter, it's less that you have to listen to, but it is a very different experience, but
it just seems like it runs, the speed of it runs just a little bit faster too, mm-hmm. like just a
Little bit, yeah.
Little bit, like very, very tiny bit, but it makes all the difference to me.
Yeah, oh, like, yeah.
Oh, wow, this is just, it just felt like I was hearing it for the first time, really.
Absolutely, and yeah, I wanted to ask you a question that I've always thought about with this song. Paul gets the criticism a lot that he writes ballads and is a soft singer and just writes pop songs, and yet you come up with songs like this that I wonder if in some ways if it's a deliberate attempt. Well, obviously it was, since he said he tried to better The Who, or at least what he expected The Who to write. But in a way it kind of gives it, maybe it's some self-credibility that actually he is a really good rock and roller and not just a balladeer. I know, I'm curious what you think about this place in his style.
Yeah, I do think it's an unfair criticism. I do think there's examples like this, like Jet.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, Oh Darling, even though that's a ballad, that just show him to be like a really powerful, like hard rock kind of player. You know, mm-hmm. Hell in Wheels, lots of examples of like, you know,
Smile Away. Really,
yeah, Smile Away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Used to Be Bad. No, that's a terrible example. Terrible. But no, I think it is an unfair criticism personally. I think he's, you know, got chops to, you know, he just two years ago he did that one with Nirvana that,
yeah, right.
You know, was nominated for Best Hard Rock Song or whatever.
Yeah.
The Grammys, not that that makes much of a difference, but
no, but it's true. And it's been leveled at him a lot because I had a book. I think I still have the book, the 50 worst rock and roll albums of all time or something like that. And then at the end it says the worst rockers of all time. And there it's Billy Joel and I can't remember the second person, and then Paul McCartney. And it's basically following the talking points about him just being a soft singer and all this stuff. And I actually wrote, I think I was in high school or something, and I wrote the author a letter saying, wait a minute, are there all these other songs where he's screaming, like the ones, you know, Oh Darling and Helter Skelter, and I never heard back. But
yeah,
I just thought it was unfair. The fact that Paul has, you know, you keep thinking about it and you have to keep hearing these songs to justify that he's actually a good singer is ridiculous at this point.
Yeah, I think it is too. I think it's a terribly moronic,
yeah, tired
argument by people.
Exactly.
Based on, I don't know very much, and I heard Silly Love Song, and I think
yeah, that, right.
You know, I feel like Silly Love Songs has really, like, just really killed his reputation over the years.
You know? I like Silly Love Songs.
I know, too, it's right? A good song.
It is a good song. I know. So we talked a little bit about the origin, or what happened to this song in history, because I think that's, I don't know, do you have anything else to say about the mechanics before we talk about the mythology behind this?
No, I think that's the big thing here with Helter Skelter that brought it up. And even what brought it up to us was a guy who wrote a book about all of this passed away. And, you know, I think it's it's sort of a shame that the Beatles or Paul or the song even gets the blame and not the crazy, crazy man. I mean, if a crazy man that claims that the moon, you know, was talking to him and so he wants to kill somebody, are we like, oh, that moon?
I know.
Bad influence.
Very, I know. Yeah, no, absolutely not. So, yeah, it's a pretty great story because it's very fascinating, the whole Charles Manson Beatles connection. And I mean, basically, Charles Manson was a failed singer, songwriter. I think the Beach Boys recorded one or two of his songs, but he was kind of hanging out with the Beach Boys, and in the late '60s. And when the White Album came out, he was struck by supposedly all of these visions and the Beatles, these messages, hidden messages that the Beatles were telling him. And so a lot of the songs on the White Album supposedly had these messages. So Piggies was about the police. Revolution 9, supposedly all the from the Bible, Revelation. There's all these things that talk about the Beatles with breastplates and armor, and there's four of them, and all this kind of stuff. And to sum it up here, the basic thing was that Helter Skelter for Charles Manson was going to be this race war between blacks and whites, and they were going to have all this fighting and a war and rise up here, and all this stuff was going to happen. They were going to kill each other, and guess who was going to be left to rule the world and who survives? Well, Charles Manson and his family. Of course. Yeah. So clearly.
Makes sense.
Clearly. So Helter Skelter took this real sinister connotation because of Manson. And so if you read the book Helter Skelter by Vince Bugliosi, he talks about how they couldn't figure out a motive for the killings that Manson and his family did. And so they started to research this a bit more. And there's probably a good 30 pages in the book about the Beatles' White Album and the connections. And I highly encourage you to read it if you haven't read it before. But they really got into it. And all the other killers and members of Manson's family talked about how Manson just preached this Beatles album and Helter Skelter all the time. So it really has taken on a bad connotation. And so when Paul was asked about it, he said, "I don't understand where this came from." John was asked in the Playboy interviews about it, and he said, "All that Manson stuff was built around George's song about pigs and this one. It has nothing to do with anything." And he said, and then back in the Rolling Stone interview of 1970, Lennon said something about, "I don't know how we got to knifing people based on this song. It makes no sense to me." So they were really disgusted by what happened. And for better or for worse, that's kind of how you know this song now. It's definitely associated with it. So I don't know. Pretty interesting connection, but a pretty morbid one.
Yeah, it's very morbid. The whole Sharon Tate story is just a real sad and crazy story, and it's been a fascination of people. I mean, how many years later is it?
Yeah, 1969.
Talking about it all the time still, and still movies being made about it and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's very sad that the Beatles have a connection like that to a really, really horrible crime. It's very, very strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Catcher in the Rye with John Lennon's assassin too. Who, that's a book that when I read it in high school, I couldn't help but think about that. And it's unfortunate that these really good works are turned into things like that.
Do you think that this incident with Helter Skelter and with Charles Manson led to some of the later paranoia from parents, from the Congress, about satanic lyrics in hard rock, always hard rock, heavy metal songs.
Right.
Not any other form of music.
No.
That's, let's not analyze the, new jazz music.
No.
If there's any satanic messages there. But
no,
it's
John Coltrane, Satan. Yeah.
Because there was this one example of some crazy guy thinking he was influenced by a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's like, that creates a lot of fear.
Yep.
And so that fear leads people to be like, we've got to root out we got to put labels on these things to keep our kids from listening to these hard rock songs,
Yeah, I think definitely it contributed to that time, because the late 60s, this was 68, and then 69, 70, with all the problems in the U.S. particularly, there was this sense of fear and paranoia going on. I think the Beatles might have been insulated a little bit from it, because they were they were definitely accepted by the mainstream by that point for sure, and kind of the grand, kings of rock. So they probably escaped some of it, but it definitely was a concern later. And it always was associated with hard rock. I remember, what was it, the Judas Priest songs? Those were really in the 80s. That was what Tipper Gore or some of these people were really against.
Yeah, Tipper Gore I just remember Tipper Gore and Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa, that's right.
Frank Zappa really defending the free speech.
And yeah.
Tipper Gore being like, no, we need to put these labels on these albums so I, you know, and restrict who they're sold to. And has that worked at all? No,
of course not.
Here we are, like, what, 30 years later, and now it's like anyone can download anything for free. And,
yeah, I know.
It's all... You know, yeah. Censored and uncensored versions of it. So
exactly.
It's that type of stuff is, you know, getting less and less important. I don't know. Maybe you still think it's very important to censor that. But I think that's a parent's job of if he wants to play something for his child, yeah. You know, or not, you know, when they're at a certain impressionable age. But I think people are way too fearful of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one, it wasn't even the Beatles' fault. So they also probably get off the hook a little bit, because even if, you know, there was nothing hidden in this to begin with, yeah, that we know of, at least. There were some other things about Paul is Dead, maybe, but yeah, that's a whole different
that's,
story.
That's for
another podcast.
Another episode.
Yeah.
The last songs under the microscope we did, we couldn't find too many cover versions
of Yes It Is. That's right.
Yeah, this one, there's a ridiculous amount. Mm-hmm. The most recent was on that Art of McCartney. It was Roger Daltrey doing a version.
Oh, I've not heard that one.
we'll not play it now.
Okay.
it's so.
Yeah.
Now, the earliest I could find, earliest at least recorded, not released until the 1991 set Pandora's Box, is by a group called Aerosmith, which...
I think I've heard of them before. Yeah.
I'm sure we're all familiar with. Now, Aerosmith's a great example of a band who really would be influenced by the Beatles, obviously liked the Beatles, but more of the hard rock side of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. So let's hear Aerosmith's version of Helter Skelter.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride. When I get to the bottom and I feel like, yeah. Do you, don't you want me to love you? Coming down fast, but I'm miles above you. Tell me that you may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer.
So pretty straightforward, huh?
Yeah, it reminds me that they also did a version of Come Together, which was a pretty good, you know, very faithful rendition, but again, one of the harder type songs. And Steven Tyler's voice fits this pretty well, so it sounds pretty good. And some of the other ones, at least the other really famous one that I remember, was on Rattle and Hum by U2.
Yeah.
And it's pretty similar too, although the Edge's guitar sound is quite different. But Bono, he says something in the beginning of the song. I can't remember what it was. Kind of like, well, the Beatles did their version and here's ours, or something like that.
Yeah. And then it's just like normal.
Like normal.
So
song,
like,
yeah.
Who cares?
Like, who, yeah.
Kind of shrug your shoulder.
Right.
Just like that Aerosmith one. It's like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
might be fun.
But
in
I did
concert.
Find one that was really good.
All right.
And this was actually nominated for a Grammy in 1984. Or best new arrangement of an existing song, and it's from an a cappella group called The Bobs. So let's hear The Bobs, and they're very interesting. Helter Skelter.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Where I stop and I turn and I go for a ride until I get to the bottom and I see you again.
See you again.
Do you, don't you?
want me to love you. I'm coming down fast, but I'm miles above you.
Tell me, tell me, tell me, come on, tell me the answer. Well, you may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer. Look out now, helter skelter, helter skelter, helter skelter.
Yiddish bout it. Yiddish
bout it. Do you, don't you want me to make you?
Yiddish bout it.
Yiddish bout it. I'm coming down fast, but don't let me break you.
Yiddish bout it.
Yeah, tell me, tell me, tell me.
Wow, that completely blew me away. Did not expect that one at all. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That, yeah. I like it. It's pretty, pretty funky, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I enjoy it. The one other thing I liked that I came across was one of these mashups.
Mm-hmm.
And it mashed up Helter Skelter with Whole Lotta Love's guitar.
Oh, I could
so
see
it was
that.
Like Helter Skelter's vocals over Whole Lotta Love's guitar. So
yeah, that works. Pretty good. Same key, that would work. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty good. The interesting couple.
Yeah.
Couple of things there.
Different takes. Yeah, so I think it still is a song that does scare me to some extent. Part of it's the placement on the album, when you know it's coming, because it comes right after Sexy Sadie, which fades out, and after the fade out, it's kind of a shock when that guitar riff comes in, and then what follows it too, so the one with Long, Long, Long,
right? Yeah.
It's very surprising.
That's why I've always thought that Long, Long, Long has gotten overlooked historically, yeah. Is because it's particularly in the CD, the original CD stereo mix of it, Long, Long, Long almost doesn't exist audio.
It's so quiet.
It's so quiet compared to the, you know, volume of the Helter Skelter. On this vinyl mono mix, they seem better balanced.
Yeah.
And there's more depth to both of them.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think it really has made me appreciate both of them even more.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately one of the drawbacks of the way we listen to music now, or the way you can buy music now, is that people could just download Helter Skelter and then hear it on its own and hear it out of context from the way the Beatles actually intended it, and it loses some of the impact, at least to my ears, when you don't hear it in context. Kind of like at the end of Revolution 9, it goes into Good Night, and that's just, again, the way it was sequenced on the album just means a lot. So I think if you don't know that, it's such a contrast when it's followed by Long, 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 that it is a little bit, you kind of don't get the full story.
Yeah. Well, I've certainly appreciated it more than I had in the past, and now that we've really been talking about this today, yeah. I realize probably why is because I'm less into the type of hard rock, heavy metal type stuff that came out of the Beatles' influence, and I'm more into other type of stuff.
Right.
You know, so...
Yeah,
That's probably where my head is at, Helter Skelter wise. But good song, good song.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's why so many people love the White Album, because it's got something for everyone on it. And if you don't like Helter Skelter, you've got Long, Long, Long right after it to make up for it. So,
or Your Blues, which is to me
similar.
A more delicious, mm-hmm. well-rounded mm-hmm. hard rock song.
Yeah, it's got some more interesting things to it.
Yeah.
So, although I have to say, John Lennon's sax, quote unquote, playing at the end of Helter Skelter is one of the great moments. It comes in about a little after 3 minutes, if you're interested to find that. It's a little bit after, I think about 3:12, 3:15, something like that. And Mal Evans' trumpet, quote unquote, playing is also on there, too. So, contributing to the noise, but it's. As you say, it's listening to it in context on the mono vinyl album has maybe turned me around a little bit more, made me a little more favorable to it. So always interesting to dig into these songs a little bit more under the microscope.
Yeah, so we'll go out with, though I prefer, prefer the mono version. We'll go out with the historical stereo version in its entirety of Helter Skelter, complete with I've Got Blister. And apparently John shouted right before that, how was that? Like, talking about his saxophone playing. And Ringo, who has said in an interview that, you know, oh, I just got tired and I had to scream out, I got blisters in my finger.
Yeah, it's very excellent. And how would you rate, as being trained as a saxophone player yourself, how do you rate John's, how did you do on that, John, saxophone playing?
It's garbage. It's garbage, but it's intentionally supposed to be sort of like shrill and
yeah,
kind of like wild things happening, and it sounds like a bird's kind of flying in at some yeah, certain point. It sort of sounds like seagull noises and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
so it actually is pretty effective, but it's kind of
yeah. In the meantime, thanks again for listening and enjoy the full stereo version of Helter Skelter, and we'll catch you next time.
When I get to the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. When I stop and I turn and I go for a ride, till I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you, don't you want me to love you?
Vegas!